We're more dependent now on our habits than we've ever been before. But in terms of being creatures of habit, our psychology and the biology of habits is really similar to, you know, I think the beginning of time.
So I have a question for you. Why is it some people have an intention or a habit and they then go through with it and others don't? And this has been something I've been obsessed about now for a little while. So I got Dr. Gina Cleo on the podcast. You're about to hear our conversation. She's a habits expert and she's got a new book out, which is down below, all about habits. And I just became really, really interested in this. I work with a number of clients in the breathwork world, and those that get the most transformative results are the ones that spend their time doing the exercises that I prescribe, that I recommend for them. And those that don't find the time to do them, they just don't get the same results. And so it was a bit of a head scratcher. We all know that these breathing exercises are really healthy and they're good for us, and I go through the science, and yet some people, it just, they create a habit and they stick to it. And I've seen incredible results. And so I thought, let's just get somebody on that can explain how to create a habit, why we fail sometimes at habits, what's the benefits, if any, of habit stacking, what's going on in the brain when we look to create habits, how can we use the science of habits to make transformations in our own lives. So this is really exciting. It's not just about breath work, even though Dr. Gina actually practices breath work, which is really cool and just a bonus. This is going deeper on anything that we do in our lives. What are the things that are conspiring against us, and what can we do to not only make a change, but actually make that change stick? So Dr. Gina's been featured all over the place. She's very accomplished. She's really interesting to listen to, and you're going to have a great time in this podcast. So get comfy. If you haven't done so already, before we go ahead, can you please consider subscribing to this podcast? If you're listening to it, please click the subscribe button wherever you're listening. And if you're watching it here on YouTube, please click the button, because over 55% of people are watching and not subscribing, and it means you're missing out on cool new content. We've got breathing exercises coming out every week. We've got podcasts landing every Friday now, because that's what I asked and people said that was the best day for them. So please consider subscribing so you get notifications straight away. Also, the subscriber number really does help us get bigger, grander, more hard to reach guests. My goal this year is to find Dr. Andrew Huberman and get him on this podcast. He just featured one of my breathing techniques, which is really cool. If somebody watching this knows Huberman and can make a connection, yes, please, we will do this. That's the plan this year, 2024. Anyway, enough yakking from me. Let's take a breath together. I hope you enjoy this podcast. And as always, at the end of the Take a Deep Breath podcasts is a free guided breathing exercise. This week's is heart coherence, so enjoy that. So stick around at the end and enjoy the breath work with me as well. Thank you. Here is Dr. Gina, and here's how we're going to change our lives in 2024 with the science of habits. Thank you. Why the hell are we making habits and breaking habits? I'm thinking of New Year's Eve. I'm thinking about setting all these wonderful intentions. I'm thinking about December the 11th when I'm back on the chocolate and alcohol again. What's going on?
I mean, we make habits and break habits because essentially we want to make changes in our lives, right? We make habits because they create brain space for us. And I can, you know, go into that a bit more in a bit more detail. But we break habits because we realize that we want our life to pivot in a different way, that something that we're doing isn't serving us anymore, or it isn't aligned with our values or with our intentions. And so we decide to break them. But the flip side is sometimes we break our good habits because they may be more difficult to maintain or to achieve or to sustain, or to, you know, we've got a competing interest. It's much easier to press snooze and stay in bed a little longer than it is to get up and go for a planned run. So that's sometimes why we break some of our good habits as well.
What is the difference between a person that makes and breaks habits consistently or constantly, a bit like me, I think, and those people that set a habit and then keep a habit? What's going on? Is there something different in the brain? Can you just explain a bit about why there are those different types of people, or are there those different types of people?
I think we're both. I think everybody's both. I think we all have habits that we've started and then we've fallen off the wagon, and then we might chase them again and then we forget about them and we sort of cycle in and out of them. And then some of our habits we've started and we've maintained. And we might not even be aware of what some of those are. Like for you, it might be starting the day with a cup of tea or some breath work. For someone else, it might be the way they dry themselves after a shower. It's exactly the same sequence day in and day out. And for other people, it might be their entire daily routine is completely habitual and automatic. And so we're actually all the same in that way. I think we're all very good at starting habits. We're not very good at maintaining them long term. So for those of us who do maintain our habits, you know, more frequently, I guess, than other people, what they're probably doing is they're practicing consistency. They have more resilience. They're persevering. They've created an environment that facilitates and supports that habit. And they're doing all the right strategies. It's small, consistent actions done in a repeated manner. And they've created those beautiful neural pathways in the brain. They'll be under less stress. They're sleeping well. You know, there's so many factors that fall into this a perfect environment, I guess, for us to maintain these habits long term. So don't be too hard on yourself there, Mike.
Is there there's a lot of talk I've seen on the internet about, I don't know, 21 days to create a habit and things like that. What's the truth around all that sort of stuff?
Oh gosh, I'm so glad you asked me that question, because it's like my favorite thing to debunk is how long it takes to create a habit. This 21 day, I guess, theory has been around for decades, but interestingly, it has absolutely no research to back up that claim. It was actually a study in the 1960s by a surgeon who was doing facial reconstruction for his patients. And he found that after about 3 weeks or 21 days, his patients were no longer shocked when they would look in the mirror because they've had like a face that's been reconstructed. So he was like, well, it must take 21 days for neuroplasticity. That means 21 days to change a habit. But that's not at all the same. You know, I think if it took 21 days to create a new habit, we would all live perfect lives because we can commit to anything really for 3 weeks' time. Mm-hmm. But the reality is it actually takes, there's a range. It takes anywhere between 18 days to up to a year to create a new habit. And the reason there's such a big range is because there's so many varying factors, like how complex the habit is that you're trying to create. The more complex the behavior, the longer it's going to take for your brain to really make this complex behavior automatic and subconscious compared to a simple behavior, which is just really easy to do. So your brain's like, oh, yeah, I can be in the flow with this much quicker. It could also be how habitual you are as a person. My husband loves routine. He loves like the rigidity of, you know, a day in, day. He loves that predictability. I'm the opposite. I love spontaneity. I never have two meals the same. I'll go to a different restaurant and order a different thing just for fun. So it takes him a shorter period of time to create new habits than it does for me. But it takes me less time to break old habits than it does for him because he's really set in that routine. So there are certain things that do impact. It still comes down to consistency and perseverance. So we all have the capacity to change our habits and to, you know, make it really as quick as we really want it to be through strong intentions.
Okay. Cool. Very interesting. Are there different archetypes then and personalities, and some do better than others when it comes to creating habits?
If I had a wish list, on the very top of my list would be a research that confirms this very question. And it's actually a topic that I'm so interested in going into a field of research for, because we don't have empirical evidence to answer that question. We have a lot of anecdotal evidence to show that certain people, for example, who display characteristics of conscientiousness tend to be more habitual or more in control of their habits compared to someone who's just a little bit, I guess, more turbulent or, you know, really values that spontaneity and the pleasure seeking, I guess. But if we put it on a scale, and I guess you can probably reflect on this and ask yourself where you may sit on the spectrum, but say on one side of the spectrum, you're somebody who really loves to seek pleasure. You love roller coasters. You love thrill. You love breaking rules. You love when something different is happening. And then on the other end is anxiety avoiders. Anxiety avoiders tend to prefer systems that are the same and they're predictable and they don't need variation because, hey, if it's working well, why do we need to change it? So let's just stick to how things are. So if we can, you know, grossly overgeneralize and we say this is sort of the spectrum, the anxiety avoiders tend to be much more habitual than the thrill seekers. Mm. And it's kind of self-explanatory why that would be. Our habits keep us in a predictable routine. They're safe, they're comfortable. And so someone who's more of an anxiety preventer is going to feel really good about their habits. Where would you say you sit on that spectrum?
I was just thinking about that because I love to go to new restaurants. I love to try new things. Yeah. I also don't want to have anxiety in my life. I always struggle with those archetypes. I always feel like, I've never found one that like, I think everyone feels fits. Like this, but I never feel like there's one that always defines me. But yeah, it's when it comes to habits, I guess where does grit fit into this and discipline? Where do those sit when it comes to habits?
Yeah, I mean, that comes back to that the perseverance point. Mm. And when we're creating a new habit or breaking an old habit, in that initial phase, we need grit, we need determination, we need willpower. But once we're in the flow of it, you know, once that new behavior really becomes a habit, it becomes subconscious, and then we don't need willpower. We don't need to be conscious about the behavior because it happens automatically. It's like every time you sit in the car, no matter how stressed you are, how tired or sleepless you are, you will still put your seatbelt on because it's a habit that you've always done. And it's the same with all of our habits. They will happen in our world without us needing to exert mental resources or grit to make it happen.
Mm, mm. Where does the whole brushing your teeth thing come in? Because I hear that thrown around a lot. Well, you brush your teeth every day, so you should be able to do X, Y, and Z. And we've got a little one at the minute, so we're trying to get him to brush his teeth. And it's not going very well, but he's very young. But I do think about that a lot. I think, well, I do brush my teeth every day. Is that a helpful thing or is that not a very helpful thing when people compare certain habits like brushing your teeth? I'm just going to pause from Dr. Gina for a second. We are a pivotal time in our lives. Things have never been busier. I feel like people are more stressed than they have ever been in my life. And that's where the transformative power of breath work comes in. This is not woo-woo. These are science-backed breathing techniques. You're here watching a podcast about breathing, so you're probably already down this road already. There are a number of ways that you can work with me. You can be on the YouTube channel, you can watch the podcast, you can play with exercises, or you can jump into a one-to-one with me where I go through specifically what you need in terms of we'll do some breath assessments, I'll ask you to complete a questionnaire, and I will build something just for you. I will breathe with you. I'll give you the nuances of each of the breath exercises that you need to help you get to your goals, and I'll be your accountability buddy. This year, I'm looking for a personal trainer to help me improve some back issues, maybe lose a little bit of extra weight and get a little bit more flexible. I know I can't do this by myself. I know I need to go out there and get somebody that's going to tell me what to eat, when to exercise. I'm not going to watch 50,000 podcasts on these things. I want somebody to tailor it. And that's what I do with the breath. So if this is something you're interested in, the link is down below. I have a very limited number of slots. We sold out all of last year. I'm very, very blessed. Thank you so much, everyone that I worked with. And we've had incredible transformations. I've had clients that were feeling stressed, could barely hold their breath, couldn't take a deep breath. And within 6 to 8 weeks, they were able to, I think, quadruple their breath holds, feel calmer, made changes in their career, started doing a lot more exercise. People that stopped shouting at their kids because they had more patience, more resilience. And so many other clients. I've got a link and you'll see all the testimonials. It's a wonderful job. I love doing it. So if you're interested in one-on-one coaching, the link is down below. Back on with Gina. Cheers.
We probably use the word, like, you know, that terminology of brushing teeth because we can assume that most adults do brush their teeth every day. So it's a really good analogy to show that this is a habit. You don't have to set an alarm to do it. You don't need a reminder. You know, it's part of your daily routine. So I do think it's helpful. I don't think it's helpful to say, if you can do this, then you can do all these other things. Mm-hmm. Because the thing is, for us to be really convinced to do a new habit, there's recipe involved in that. And there are parameters around it. And one of the main ones is finding a sense of reward in that new behavior. You brush your teeth when you're younger because you don't want to get told off by your parents. And then you don't want to get told off by your dentist. And then you don't want to have terrible breath or whatever it might be, right? Like, we have value in it. And then eventually the value of it becomes, well, this is just my routine and it feels weird when I don't do it. So I'm really comfortable doing this and I just want to do it for the sake of that. But as a one-year-old or, you know, as a baby or a toddler, you don't have the reward of that. You just want to go play and go to bed and not worry about this whole teeth brushing thing. It's weird and it feels unnecessary. So you have to find the reward value for the other habits that you want to create that, and it won't be the same as brushing your teeth.
So is that a bit of a hack then? Because I've heard like people say things like, I don't know, do the paperwork and at the end of it, have a nice piece of chocolate. Is that the sort of stuff we're talking about, or is that too simplistic?
Yeah, it is slightly simplistic. I think what they're trying to do is like reward learning, right? Reward-based learning. So if you think like, so you've got a child and when they grow up, you might say, okay, if they do their chores, you're going to put a gold star on a board. And when you do that, they're going to feel awesome about it. They'll be like, yes, I got a gold star. I want to do that again. And it actually reinforces the behavior in our life. And the thing with creating rewards is, the interesting thing is, we don't grow out of that reward learning as adults. We love rewards. But the rewards that people will sort of try to offer, like that chocolate, is not necessarily that valuable or that helpful. The most helpful, the rewards, are emotional ones. So finish the paperwork and take a moment of mindfulness to go, I'm really proud of myself for doing that. I didn't want to do it. I didn't procrastinate any longer on it. I finally got it done and I'm stoked. And I'm going to take 5 minutes, 10 minutes, the rest of the afternoon off to myself to do whatever it is I want to do. Or I'm just going to sit here and just take a moment to acknowledge that I did that. And it's not being cocky. It's not being like, oh, I'm so super superior. It's actually just allowing ourselves to feel a sense of pride. And that reinforces the behavior because our brain goes, well, that felt really good. I got a hit of dopamine from feeling that fuzzy emotion. We should totally do that again. And that's what reinforces it. Giving people external rewards, like the one I often hear is, oh, if you work out, then give yourself for a week, like go get a massage at the end of the week. It's not practical and it's not reinforcing the daily actions. I want someone to be stoked with themselves if they set an alarm and they actually got up out of bed and they put their activewear on and got in the car. Like, even if you didn't do a workout, you still got a step closer than not doing it at all. And it takes away from celebrating all the little wins, which I think is so important.
So that feels like you're saying more of an intrinsic reward system. So really being grateful for what you've done as opposed to setting something outside. Okay, I like that.
Yeah.
That feels more natural.
Yeah.
And I haven't got to then go, oh, I didn't go to the massage either. Bloody hell, I let myself down there. Or I forgot to buy the chocolate. So with me, since I've had the little one, especially recently, some things have started shifting in my brain. So for example, like my workout routine's just become insane. I've just started working out like all the time. And there's this thing around, oh, you know, I want to do it for him and make sure, you know, be a role model to him. And but I've never kind of worked this well and this consistently. So what might be going on there in terms of being like a parent or like having this, I don't know, having this responsibility, and that's kind of shifted something in the brain.
Wild, Mike. Most people go the opposite way and they're like, I'm not sleeping, I've got less time, you know, I want to spend, you know, I'm here with my kid, I have all these responsibilities, and we get caught up in the to-do lists. I would say, you know, we will create the biggest shifts in our lives when our environments change, when something in our life has dramatically changed. So it's generally moving house, starting a new job, bringing home a baby, divorces, marriages, you know, big changes create big transitions in our life. And that's because our environment is different and our habits are very driven by our environments. So it might be something like that. It could be something along the lines of like a shifting schedule, or you've placed more importance on exercise because you really notice the value of it now. And it's, you notice the importance of it for your mental health and your physical health, and you need that now more than you did before. So there's got to be some sort of shift in that. What would you say, like, you know, with these examples, do any of them resonate?
Yeah, I watch silly little memes and stuff and reels and TikToks now and again, and I've seen these things around don't make your kids your excuse, make them your reason. And that one really resonated with me. Also, I'm an older parent. I'm sort of 41, and my back was getting quite sore, and I was like, I need to work out a bit more, otherwise I'm not going to lift my kid. And I also we went on some roller coasters recently with my nephew, who's 17. I was like, bloody hell, I'm gonna have to do this in another 17 years. I'm gonna be nearly 60 then. So there's been a few motivators to go, shit, you need to get yourself in better shape for this sort of stuff. So
and there you go, they're all intrinsic, really, aren't they? Yeah. It's like you've been driven by an internal desire that is so valuable to you, and it's more important to you than not working out. And so it becomes a routine, and it's easy, and you want to do it a lot. And that's the beauty of motivation in that way, is you don't have to grind. Is it can happen if you just put your mindset in the right space.
Yeah, very cool. I'm loving the way that you're asking me questions on this as well. That's ace. I feel like it's very nice conversational.
Oh, cool.
And it's making me think, oh, so I'm getting a bit of a free session here. So I'm a breath coach. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about breath work maybe in a bit as well. I have a lot of clients, and the clients that I tend to have, entrepreneurs, CEOs, high performance people, very busy. They're very successful. They're very busy. And a lot of them are very good at implementing the habits, but some are not. And even though the benefits of breath work are very clear, there's a lot of scientific evidence, people wouldn't be coming to me if they didn't understand the benefits already. They just want the structure. They want the accountability. Accountability is a big one. So I'm with them on WhatsApp. You know, we're doing daily practices. We're on Zoom a couple of times a week. There's a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
But some people just can't seem to find the time. So what I've done is I've broken it right down. I mean, I'm really asking for around 22 minutes of breath work practice every single day. That's the minimum effective dose.
Mm-hmm.
But some people struggle to do a couple of minutes, even though they've invested all this money, all this time. What could be done there? Any what? Because for me, it's about how do I help them embed this breathwork in their busy life? But I feel like one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you is so many of us want to do breathwork, meditation, yoga, fill in the blank. We know it's so good for us, and yet we're so quote unquote busy that we just can't seem to squeeze it into our day, even though we know it's going to be so good when we do it. So I would just love to get, that's quite a big bit there, but I'd love to get your thoughts on some of that.
Oh, I love that. There's so much like juicy details to unpack with this one. The number one predictor of success is self-efficacy. It's the belief in ourself and our ability to be able to achieve a task. And in the same way, the number one reason we feel a lack of motivation to do something that we know is good for us is lack of self-efficacy. It's not believing that we're doing it properly, or that we know how to do it, or that the way we're doing it is actually going to generate any benefit. So that's one of the things. The other thing is the lack of intrinsic reward value that we put on something. So I'll share a story with you. A couple of years ago, I wanted to start a gratitude journal, and it was like during COVID, and I was like, oh yeah, I'm like seeing that this is a really good idea, and I'm going to reduce my stress. And so I'm going to challenge myself and start this gratitude journal. And I'm generally quite a grateful, optimistic person. So it's not that I needed to, you know, like change my perspective. I just wanted the practice of doing it, especially before bed, because I wanted to get like even better sleep. And I started doing it for a couple of days, and then I was falling off the wagon with this habit, and I'm like, yo, I am a habit coach. Like, I should definitely be able to do this one. And I just couldn't get myself to do it. Fast forward a year later, I read a clinical trial on the benefits of gratitude journaling. And it listed so many things that really resonated with me, things that were important for me. And one of them was getting better sleep. And it actually talked about like the increased REM sleep and the deep sleep. It talked about the reduction in inflammation. And there was actually measurable and objective outcomes that I could say, well, if I practiced a gratitude journal every day, these are the outcomes that I could achieve in my life. And then it became real, and it became really valuable. It wasn't just like, this is good for me. It was like, oh no, this has the power to change my life in these ways that are important to me. So there's cognitive knowledge. We all know breathwork is good for us, but does it resonate deeply with our with our values, with our intentions for our life. Because here's the thing, 22 minutes, we all have it, every single one of us. I run two global companies. I have 22 minutes that I can give you. I would love to know, you know, the average person spends 2.5 hours scrolling through social media. That's literally like, I'm talking also CEOs. I run questionnaires when I do my corporate speaking events. And one of the questions I always ask is, you know, confess your unwanted habit, your most common unwanted habit. And the number one thing that comes through is I scroll on my phone too much. And I'm talking CEOs to middle management to new grads. Everyone says similar things. I think it's a perceived lack of time. It's a perceived lack of motivation, when I think it's really about the lack of awareness about the true benefits of breathwork for that individual person. I think it doesn't work just giving someone a list of benefits. It has to resonate with their soul. You know, they have to go, I can see how this will change my life. And then the other thing is, they really need to feel it. They need to do it, get the benefit and go, okay, here's the reward learning. Now I get it. Mm. And that it's like with you, the exercise, that it will just fuel the motivation to keep doing it.
Mm. That's so good. Cause that's really powerful, because yeah, I'm just thinking about one particular client right now and their goals with their children. And I need to go and find a study now that helps reinforce what their goals are, as opposed to going, it's going to reduce your stress and it's going to help you sleep better. Actually, that's not important for that particular client. They need X.
And exactly. So
that's really good. Thank you. That's ace. That's really ace.
Pleasure. Yeah, pleasure.
I heard, I forget which podcast it was, maybe it was Modern Wisdom, and somebody was talking about, I already regret that this week just gone, I spent too much time on my phone. And so I think Chris Williamson, he was saying that, I already know that when people are on their deathbed in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, one of the things they were going to say, I think it's normally things like, I didn't spend time with my children, I worked too hard. And I think one of the new ones he said is going to be, I spent too much time on my phone. And that was so shocking, because it's so accurate, because we already say that today in the micro. So by the time we're talking and looking back over our lives. So let's talk about that. What the hell can we do about these alluring devices that are so pretty and they're so demanding of our time? And yet somehow 30 years ago, we didn't need them. And yet now I listen to a book while I'm going to sleep, or, you know, what can we do about this thing that is a very powerful tool, and incredibly, we're very lucky to have it, but B has a bit of a dark shadow side to it as well.
Yeah. Phones are so dopaminergic. You know, they give us a sense of reward and anticipation, especially social media. You know, we're scrolling through and there's colors and sounds and vibrations and there's notifications and there's all these things that are stimulating us. Now, it's really important to remember that the people who are developing these phones and these apps have an incredibly sophisticated team of people who are, their sole role is to keep us on our phones for as long as possible. We're talking neuroscientists, behavioral scientists, like psychologists, who literally have created these apps to keep us scrolling, because the longer we're on them, the more money they're making. So there's that, you know, we're fighting against like big, you know, I call it, it's an establishment. Like, we need to feel like we want to be anti-establishment sometimes. But there's strategies that we need to implement, I think. And the first one is, do not depend on your self-control. If you're, for example, like scrolling on your phone before bed and you don't want to do that anymore, do not have your phone next to your bed and be like, I'm not going to scroll on my phone, because it's really hard. What we actually need to do is create an environment that facilitates and helps our goals. So one of those things could be charging your phone in a different room and then having something else that you can do before bed, whether it's reading a book or something similar, so that when you go over and reach for the phone, which is going to be a reflexive action, then you're like, oh, my phone's not there. I'll just guess I'm reading my book now. And it's the same with like when you wake up. I mean, no, it's advised not to check your phone for the first 15 minutes, because your brain is still in a state of waking up. It's our most creative time of the day. And looking at our phone ruins all that. But I think the first thing we really need to do is identify the triggers. When is it that you're looking at your phone mostly? Is it that when you're feeling a certain way, or is it because you're wanting to avoid being bored, or is it an idle moment, or what are you avoiding essentially? And once we've identified those triggers, we can preempt them and get in the way of them. And then there's also, you know, there's tech limiting apps that we can use, and then create as many barriers as you can. I have deleted apps off my phone that I was using way too much. With social media, I actually have to log in every time because I log out every time. And sometimes like I'll pick up my phone, I'll be like, ugh, can't be bothered putting my password in. Nah, and then I'll put it away. So creating, we love the path of least resistance. So I, you know, create barriers, don't depend on your willpower.
I love that. I've seen people with lock boxes to put their phones in during the day as well.
Yeah, I mean, what you need.
And then I was talking to somebody else that had just says put it in the drawer, but I was like, I don't know, there's something very ceremonial about putting it in a little box. And
yeah,
interesting. Yeah,
because they are very... boxes as well, you can put timers on them.
Yes, I've heard this. Yeah,
whereas a drawer, you can just like cheat just your way out of it, right?
Yeah.
I have out of sight, out of mind. I would say keep it out of sight. And I did, like, I won't have my phone. I've got no phone zones in my house. One of them is my office. The other is my dining table, and the other is my lounge. Like if I'm on my lounge, because I'm generally spending time with my family when I'm at the dining table or on the lounge. Also, if we're on the lounge, we might be watching telly, and I have this rule of no more than one screen at once. And so I won't have it then. And then I don't have it in the office because, goodness, it is the perfect procrastination tool. When I was writing my PhD, there'd be so many times where I'm like, I'm stuck on a word. I'm like, then I'll just like grab my phone and start playing Tetris for like half an hour. I'm like, well, this is not going to help me. And so I don't want to associate the procrastination, which is, you know, hard. It's already easy to fall into, with a really quick fix that's reflexive and it's a dopamine hit. Because then every time I get an email I don't want to respond to, or have a difficult conversation, or get stuck on a word, I'm going to grab my phone. And now I'm creating a cycle where procrastinating is easy. I'm getting rewarded for it with dopamine. And it's a really terrible cycle to get into. So no phones in my office.
I love that. I've just made a note of that because that is something I'm going to adopt straight away.
Ooh, goody.
I love it. How I've seen a lot of stuff around dopamine detox. Is there any truth to that? And should we be doing something about that?
I think dopamine detoxing, when done right, can be really powerful. I think what people do, though, is they take it really extreme, and it can actually make you feel absolutely miserable. And I do not recommend it. And this is probably a really controversial opinion. But basically, the idea of dopamine detoxing is to eliminate the things in our lives that we're feeling somewhat addicted to, or really drawn to, I guess, a bit out of control with. So that could be things like screens, like phones, television. It could be sugar, alcohol, nicotine, you know, whatever it might be for you. The idea of detoxing, though, is eliminating it entirely. And it's generally done for 30 days. There is research to show that if we eliminate something that we feel somewhat addicted to for 30 days, it's a great idea. Our brain starts to change the neural pathways around our association of that being really rewarding, and it sort of tends to fall away as a strong habit. But if we're doing too many things at once, if we're now not using social media at all, and we've cut out sugar, and now we're not having coffee, it's actually too much. And now your brain's like, whoa, I'm not feeling any dopamine, like certainly nowhere near as much as I used to feel before. And dopamine makes us feel good. And so we can actually fall into this really miserable state, and it becomes all or nothing. And then what's going to happen after the 30 days? You're going to be like, yes, I'm done. And you're going to binge on all of that stuff that you've missed out on, because it hasn't been an enjoyable or a kind process. I think you need to just take it slow. You know, my advice with it is, if you want to use your phone less, decide to do it for 10 minutes less a day, or not for the first half an hour of your day, or cut it out an hour before bed. Like, set specific parameters rather than be all or nothing with it. And then once those parameters become habitual and you're in the groove of it, add some more. Now it's like, well, now I won't take my phone to the bathroom with me, or I won't take it when I'm out for my walk. And you can add things, but don't do it all at once. You'll feel lousy.
And is that same thing true with habits as well? If you're trying to create a new habit, just do one thing at a time, or because you hear this thing, habit stacking. But then I think that, again, could you just explain a little bit about what habit stacking is, if that's actually a thing? And if I've got 15 things, like, I'll give you just a little example. I felt so bad last year because there's so much pressure on the morning routine now, especially if you think you're like an entrepreneur or something. So cold shower, meditate, journal, weight resistance, go for a run, ground on the earth. I can't remember what they all are now. Breath work on top of it. There's like 30 things, and you do one and then you feel rubbish because you haven't done the rest. So, and I've worked on that a lot, and I feel a lot better about that now. But I would love your thoughts on, do we start with one thing at a time, 10 things? You know, what's the science saying about that?
Do you know, I've had the same experience where I was like, I want to overhaul my mornings and do all this stuff. And I felt the same. I was like, I just can't. I mean, how do I fit in all these things and start work at 9 a.m.? Like, I don't understand how I can do it all. But our brains are only capable of changing up to 3 things at one time. And so your list of, you know, goals, which probably looks more like Santa's Christmas wish list than, you know, a set of realistic ambitions, the more you put on there, the less likely you are to achieve it. And I don't say that to be pessimistic. It's literally, that's just what the science says. And actually the science says that if you just focus on one thing at a time, you're much more likely to sustain it long term. If you just did that, you got in a routine with it, and then you can add something else later down the track. So it's the same, exactly the same thing. I tried to do 5 small things because I was like, oh yeah, I've got a high capacity, I'm a behavioral scientist, I got this, I'm going to do 5 things and I'll make sure they're really small. It was literally like, meditate for 10 minutes, drink 2 glasses of water first thing in the morning. You're like, simple things, right? And I started with a 5 and I just could not get consistent with it. I cut it down to 4. I was a little more consistent, but, you know, 2 weeks into it, I was like, damn it, it still feels like a chore. And then I cut it down to 3 weeks, easy. Like, I can do it. 3 habits. And then I was just like, I was consistent with it. And I'm like, okay, you can't argue with the neuroscience, even if you're someone who has a fairly high capacity. So up to 3 changes, I would go with 1 at a time and then add things in there. But your question regarding habit stacking, this is a term that became popular through the book Atomic Habits. It's actually not a scientific terminology. So we don't find that in like clinical evidence. But essentially, the concept of it is the habit loop. And the habit loop is all describing essentially that all our habits are triggered by something. And so, you know, sitting in the car is a trigger for putting on your seatbelt. Your morning routine is a trigger for brushing your teeth. So habit stacking is essentially stacking a new habit onto a habit that you're already doing. So if you're brushing your teeth in the evening, you could add flossing and you sort of stack those habits together. And that's the idea of it. It's really not, it's not profound, because there are 5 habit triggers. And what habit stacking describes is just attaching a new habit to something you're already doing. But you could also do it to the time of day, the place you're in, the emotion you're feeling, the thing that you've just done beforehand. So I think it's a bit limiting, actually. Having said that, if habit stacking is valuable for you and it's a concept that resonates with you, awesome. Like, stick, you know, do it. That's totally cool.
Yeah, okay, cool. Have you come across a book, 10X is Easier Than 2X by Dan Sullivan? I'll just finish that. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
I've heard of the book. I haven't read it, though.
It's really good. And he's got another one called The Gap and the Gain. And I'm just halfway through that. Anyway, in this book, he and it's a lot about business, but it's about life in general. He's saying, you know what, you can, let's say, again, coach, rather than trying to focus on doubling your clients next year, think about what will 10X look like? And actually, it's a completely new set of like thinking. And like, if you're going to 10X the business, you might need to remove yourself from the business and completely rethink everything. It's very, very exciting. It got me thinking, like, I'm always trying to lose a bit of weight here and there. And I thought, what if, just for the sake of it, you wanted to get into amazing shape and have a 6-pack? It's a silly goal, but it was a goal that I was like, okay, what would that look like? Well, I would definitely stop drinking. I would hire a personal trainer. And so it suddenly gave me a whole new way of thinking about things. And then it got me thinking about this thing around accountability. I know you've talked about the benefits of intrinsic motivation, but this thing around hiring a personal trainer or a coach, or getting into a group. Where do those things sit when it comes to habit forming? Because I know that I've got three coaches that coach me on different things, business, marketing, wellness, all those sort of things. So where do you sit in that kind of spectrum of going out there and getting somebody to help you?
Oh, I love that you've done that. You know, I talk about accountability quite a lot in my book because accountability has been shown to double our chances of success. When I ran my clinical trial throughout my PhD, a lot of the participants, when they came back for that like end of study measurements, and they did so well, and I interviewed them, I was like, what was it, you know, that worked for you? And a lot of them said, we didn't want to let you down. And I was like, oh no, that's not what I wanted. Like, I wanted you guys to implement the strategies. But it's also such a powerful strategy because I think we're happy to let ourselves down, but we're not so inclined to want to let somebody else down. And also, when we know that someone's checking in, then we have the sense of, oh, I better do this. I better show up because they're investing their time in me. And so I want to honor that. And it's powerful. And I love that you have three coaches. I think that's incredible that, you know, you can be a coach, but you're still leaning on other people for what they're really good at. I think it's essential. I think it's incredible. Accountability, you know, it can be with a coach. When it comes to habits, it could also be through a habit tracker. So it's ticking off when you've done a habit every time. The ones that work even better are habit trackers where a coach can see it.
Oh.
Like double accountability.
Oh. I love that. I love that so much.
I've got a list of habit tracker apps on my website. So, you know, feel free to jump on there and pick the ones that resonate with you.
Yeah.
Because there's ones that really makes a difference. This is actually a study I read the other day. It was fascinating. It showed that when people were creating new habits, they were really consistent with their habits as long as they were tracking the habits, self-monitoring. As soon as they stopped self-monitoring, they stopped doing the habits. When they started self-monitoring in, they created the habits again. It's like, it's almost like habits and that accountability goes hand in hand.
I love that. I found the easiest thing the other day, you know, sometimes you see something and it's so simple and you think, why didn't I know about that before? So Arnold Schwarzenegger's got a new book out called Be Useful, which I highly recommend. It's so wonderful to get this life advice off this guy that's been successful in so many areas. And he talks about when he was in the gym, and again, this is so blinking simple. He has a piece of chalk. And because he goes around the gym now, and obviously it's Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was Mr. Universe seven times. He goes around the gym and he talks to people. What are you doing today? And I go, oh, I'm just working out. Well, yeah, but what? Why? And they go, well, my doctor told me to work out. Yeah, but what's your goal today? And people don't. And I was like, he's talking about me. So he goes into the gym and he has a piece of chalk and he will write on the wall what he wants to do. And every time he does a rep, he marks it off.
Yes.
And then he does the 5-bar gate. And I was like, that seems really good. And so I started again, another thing, my wall is just covered in chalk now in my gym downstairs.
I love that.
And it's a reminder of all the workouts I've done so far.
Yeah.
Each time I'm like, oh, I'm really tired, but I can do one more and I'll go and I'll get that 5-bar gate. That has been an absolute, I can't honestly, it's so hard to convey how powerful it is because it sounds so simple.
Yeah. And do you find, Mike, that every time you tick it off, you're like, yes, like I'm closer now and it feels really good? That's that reinforcement learning, that reward learning. So powerful. I've seen sales team have goals and they'll say, okay, I've got to make 100 phone calls today. Mm-hmm. And they put 100 marbles in one jar and they'll move the marbles across into an empty jar every time they've made a call. And just that visual, you know, that the visual, I guess, representation of their progress, so powerful. And I love lists. I'm such a list person. If I do a task and it wasn't on my list, you better believe I'm going to write it on my list just so I can cross it off, because that sense of satisfaction, you know, that accomplishment is so good.
Yeah, I do. I've started doing this thing now where I've got my little list in the mornings and I don't like to cross it out now because I want to see what I did. So I use the highlighter to highlight the line I've done, and that way I can still see what, oh, okay, they're the things, as opposed to like, and I tick it off anyway. That's just a
better
silly
idea.
Thing that
I like that. I'm gonna do that.
So, yeah, thanks. And you go back and you can sit, and then you can go back and go, okay, what did I do on Tuesday? Okay. There's all, anyway.
Love it.
When do you think humanity started creating habits?
Because we were obviously hunter-gatherers and we were probably quite reactive. And what's your inkling on, like, when we go, do you know what, today, I'm rather than be go for saber-toothed tiger, I'm going to go and plant something, or I'm going to go and, like, play with my kids. And I need to play with my kids more. Do you think it's a fairly recent thing, like it's come with the modern age and the industrial age, or do you think we've always been habit creators and habit trackers?
I mean, we've always been creatures of habit. I do think that we're more habitual now than we have ever been before. We make over 35,000 decisions every single day. And if we had to make each and every one of those consciously, we would be completely exhausted. We couldn't survive in the world. And whether the decisions were around survival in hunter-gatherer or if they're around, you know, the best way to navigate to work, they're still decisions. If you think of, you know, the simple act of sitting down, you just think of it as I'm going to sit down, but actually your brain is going through a myriad of decisions of where to place your feet, where to put your hands to balance you. It's thinking about how high or low the seat is from where you are. It's there's hundreds of decisions that are actually made in the simple act of just deciding to take a seat. And so the more stressed we are though, the more habitual, well, the more we fall back into our habits. I think also the more work we do and the less sleep we have, again, the more we fall back onto our habits. And so the reason I say that I think we're more habitual now than ever before, I actually mean more that we're more dependent now on our habits than we've ever been before. But in terms of being creatures of habit, our psychology and the biology of habits is really similar to, you know, I think the beginning of time.
Yeah, I love that. Can we talk a bit about sleep? Because I'm a bit of a sleep prince.
Yeah, oh,
I love
sleep.
Before I had a kid, I was obsessed. But I have to, I read Dr. Matthew Walker's book, Why We Sleep, and that ruined my sleep for about 2 years. I got so anxious about, like, oh my God, I need to get 8 hours. If you don't get 8 hours, you're going to get Alzheimer's and all this stuff kicked in. So I've got a number of sleep routines, but I'd love to know what are yours? What are your sleep habits?
Yes.
And what else have you learned about sleep and habits?
The reason I laugh at this is because I recently did a trip to Amsterdam with my best friend, Monica, and she's a psychologist. And we've been best friends for 20 plus years. And she was just fascinated with my sleep routine because she was like, I don't even recognize you. You've done all this stuff before you go to bed just to get some sleep. Now, she's a mum. I'm not. But I love sleep so much. My sleep routine. It's so funny you ask this because she literally, like, because she's a psychologist, she obviously notices human behavior. Okay, my sleep routines. Firstly, I won't look at screens for an hour before bed. Mm-hmm. I've got a no blue light, like little beacon light that I use, and it's beautiful. It's like this amber color, and it's also the globes that are in my bedroom and bathroom are now no blue light, and so I love having those there. I will... I've got a Sensate. I don't know if you've heard of the Sensate.
I've got one. Yeah, love it.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. All right. So I do Sensate. For those of you who don't know what it is, it's not a vibrator. Okay. You know, people are like, oh, it's a vibrator. It just sits on your chest and it vibrates on your sternum. And it just is really relaxing. So that it's really similar to, for me anyway, doing a 10-minute meditation or some breath work before bed. So those are the things I do. I also don't drink any fluids from about 7 p.m. because I've got a pathetic bladder and I don't want to be up like all night. I don't have much caffeine. And if I do, it's only first thing in the morning. I limit sugar in the evening. So I love dessert. I love chocolate, but I'm conscious not to have too much sugar at night. Mm-hmm. Look, there's a few things. I've got blackout curtains. I wear earplugs, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a silk pillowcase so my hair doesn't get caught on my pillow. You know, I have a few things. I would say of all the rituals that I have, my sleep ritual is the most sacred.
Beautiful.
What do you do outside of that? You know, are we on par?
Yeah, can I share some extras? So, I've got the glasses. I've got the blue light blocking glasses. My iPhone goes completely red. So if I do need to look at it, it's completely red. I've got the red lights going on. Now, here's the cherries on the cake.
Yeah.
grounding mat, earthing mat. Have you come across these?
Ooh, I haven't.
So essentially, here's the very short version of it. Up until about 60 years ago, we were always touching the planet. Mm. And we're all electrical beings. When we're disconnected, it causes a lot of problems. We get static if we touch our phone. You can actually measure the amperage going up in the human body. You touch the grounding mat. I've got one here on my desk. It goes back down to zero again. Helps reduce inflammation. There's quite a bit of science to it. There's a few podcasts on it. There's a really good documentary about it. That's worth checking out.
Yeah, but cool.
Of course, being a breath coach, the big ones, mouth taping. Have you ever tried this at night?
I have, yes.
Yeah. Yep. How did that go?
Yeah, good. Although I think it's going to sound gross. I think it peeled off and I was like dribbling on one side and I was like, okay, we need to try that again.
Yeah. There's one that can go around your lips called myotape and it's quite stretchy.
I'm going to write that down. Okay.
And that's one of my mentors has made that one and it's really good. So I can't wear it because I'm a beardy man, but you would be able to wear that here.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's worth considering, depends what you might have a tracker or not. I'll try the mouth tape. If you rip it off, then it means you definitely need it. That would be my first thing, because the fact is you're probably hungry
Great
for air in the night.
Tip. I love
the
that.
The other thing is as well, nasal strips. Oh my God, they've been a game changer. Ooh. So especially when you've a bit bunged up, maybe got a cold and you're trying to sleep. They're very inexpensive. They give you about 30% more space in the nose and it just means you're nasal breathing throughout the night. So I'm kicking into breath coach here. I'm going to stop again now. But
they're
big ones. And when you can't sleep properly, when you are mouth breathing just a little bit, it can prevent you getting into the deeper levels of sleep. So I've got clients that have the Aura ring and different things like, wow, I've never seen scores this high before with the mouth tape. And a bit of breath work as well. So when I'm doing Sensate, I tend to combine that with coherence breathing, which is known as the perfect breath. And that's around 5.5 seconds in, 5.5 seconds out. It takes a bit of pressure off the heart because the diaphragm's pumping in a certain way. Helps the heart and brain sync up. Again, there's loads of science to this.
I love this.
So you can habit stack the Sensate with the coherence. Well, yeah, they would be the big ones. Apart from that, it sounds like you've got an incredible sleep routine. I miss sleep so much because of my little baby.
You my goodness.
But at the same time, I'm very lucky. I don't have an alarm clock, so typically we sleep in until we're ready to go. So we're in
the
position.
Love this. I have a question. With the nasal strips, do you still use them if you're not sort of clogged up, or is it more for if you're feeling a bit nasally?
I would say it depends on your breath scores. I can send you some ways to test your breath health. If your breath scores are in the kind of what I'd call like the red zones, I would be using them because it probably means you're quite sensitive to carbon dioxide and you're more likely to want to mouth breathe at night. If you type up your mouth and you're not quite ready to do so, it's good because it's going to force nasal breathing, but you're going to feel a bit uncomfortable. And so I often say to clients, do both at the same time. And then later, maybe after a couple of weeks, take off the nasal strip and see how you get on.
Okay,
some clients just love it and they do both. But
awesome. My Fitbit tells me, I think, my breath rate, all of that. It's all like in the very good range, but I'm a sucker for doing even better. So let's do it. I'm keen.
Yeah, cool. Let me know how you get on. Even because it's that thing, isn't it? If you even get 1% increase, maybe it's worth
it.
You know, extra bit of sleep.
100%.
So talk to me about your breath work then. So where do you go with your breathing practices?
A friend of mine actually invited me to a breath work class. It was like a full day event with a guy called Johannes who runs Breathless Expeditions here in Australia. And he's a free dive instructor, but also trained with Wim Hof. And so we sort of did a whole bunch of different types of breathing. We did ice baths and, you know, all the sort of extreme stuff. It felt like a lot on the day, you know, we were sort of close to fainting and all this kind of stuff. But what I loved about it is it taught me how much our breath can, you know, help the rest of our body and how we can regulate our heart rate with it and all of, you know, such powerful things. And about 3 years ago, I went through a really traumatic event where I developed agoraphobia, which is the fear of leaving your own house. And I would get triggers, you know, I would try to go outside and I'd sort of be riddled with anxiety and I'd come back inside and I'd be hyperventilating. And it's the first thing I'd notice is I'm hyperventilating. And so I learned that if I can just control my breath, that actually that anxiety can dissipate from my body. And of course, there's other things I had to do, like different focuses and stuff, but the breath was so important. And I think that the workshop that I did all those years ago helped me realize, I think, you know, the sacredness of it. I've also got a couple of friends who are breathwork coaches, and it's such an honor, actually. It's such a privilege to be friends with them, because we will do things like this together where they'll come, you know, they'll come over for dinner. I'll be like, right, 15-minute session, let's go. And I've got a sauna and an ice bath in my house. And I like getting in the ice bath, particularly so that I have an opportunity to really control my mind through my breath. If I don't control my breath in a freezing cold ice bath, I'm not going to last in there. And yeah. So I guess that's been mainly my experience with it. I love it. I'm a huge, huge fan.
I was very lucky. I got a week with Wim a few years ago. Yeah. And the best advice I got from him was, when I was getting to the ice bath, I was like, ooh, and he's like, just imagine you're getting into a hot bath. How would you act? And I was like, it made such a difference. This whole relaxing piece. But obviously it's the Iceman, so whatever he says, you're gonna listen to as well.
Totally, right.
Okay, cool. I was gonna ask you, actually. So I had a client a little while ago that was looking for help with decision making and breath work. So I got on Google and PubMed and ChatGPT, and I was looking, and there's a particular breath work called bellows breath, and it's kind of it is a bit of hyperventilation, but it's more like it's almost like you're stoking the fire. It's a very old pranayama technique. So you're kind of doing this, and you're kind of using your stomach and you're pumping it in and out. And this one paper said that what's going on amongst the many things that are changing in the body is you are increasing blood flow to the prefrontal cortex, and it can be measured. Ooh. And in doing so, it's helping you make better decisions. Do you know anything about, like, not necessarily that's the breath work, but the blood flow being increased, and would that help with habits and that sort of thing potentially?
Wow. I do know that increasing blood flow to the prefrontal cortex does wonders, because our habits sit in a part of our brain called the basal ganglia, which is more the emotive part of our brain. It's an impulsive part of our brain. It's driven by things like emotions and memories and things that aren't logical, whereas our prefrontal cortex is where our intentions sit. It's where we make logical decisions and decisions that are actually going to serve us, that are part of our value systems more. So actually sitting more in prefrontal cortex is a beautiful thing. And I know that increasing blood flow to the prefrontal cortex is really powerful when it comes to, you know, aligning our behaviors with our intentions. But I've never heard of it from a breathwork perspective. I've only heard of it from doing things like TMS, which is transcranial magnetic stimulation. It's a sort of a brain magnetic tapping strategy that psychologists have been using more and more. But I would love to read that study. That sounds incredible.
I'll dig it out and send it to you.
Yeah, cool. Thank you.
We're at basically the end. This has been ace. I would love to get you back at another point, because I feel like I want to just pick your brain for hours.
Yeah.
Just talk to us about your book. Where can people find it? And where can they find you?
Thanks, Mike. So my book is being released on the 4th of January. Is this coming out after that?
It can do, yep.
Okay, yep. So I'll just say, my book is just released. It is called The Habit Revolution, and it's come out in Australia, New Zealand, the UK, and the US, and it's soon going to be in China and some other countries. So The Habit Revolution is really all about simple steps for really powerful habit change. I wanted this book to be a guide. I wanted to hold the reader's hand through a change journey, because change is not easy. Although the steps may be simple, the actual process of change is not easy. So I talk about all the things that are involved with habit change, and then all the things that are outside habit change that make habit change happen. Things like self-compassion and the importance of our environment and support and accountability, and how to set really good goals and how to recover from a setback, which is inevitable. So that's my book. It's something I'm so proud of. You know, I've worked on so many projects in my career as a habit expert, but this book is really my life's work put together. So it's something I'm really proud of. But if you want to know more about me, I also run a free habit course. It's on my website, which is drgenacleo.com. I'm also on Instagram as Dr. Gina Cleo, and all the other socials as Dr. Gina Cleo. So come say hi. I read all my emails. I respond to all my messages myself. And I love connecting with people.
Ace, thank you so much. I've got so much from this. I know the audience will have as well. So I'm going to put all your links down below. We'll release this after the book goes out. So that week, so that will be there. My last question for you, other than obviously your book, what's one book, podcast, or documentary you might recommend to somebody?
Ooh, you know what? I'm going to say watch The Social Dilemma. I think it's Netflix, and it's all about phones and phone use and social media. And it's one of those things that will help you realize, I think for most people anyway, is that once you can shift your idea about something, you don't need all this motivation and willpower anymore. It's just shifts, and then you no longer have to grind your way to doing it. I know that when I watched it, I was like, I want to be anti-establishment. I don't want to, I don't want to be stuck in this, you know, the rut of the social media thing. I don't like that it knows my behaviors and my likes and dislikes. Like, this is creepy. And yeah, I'm hardly on my phone as a result of watching that docu. So I know it's a bit left field, but that's the one I would say.
Good. I loved it. Yeah, really, really powerful. And no phone zones. That's the thing I'm taking so much from this, but no phone zones is a huge one. So thank you. Gina, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on Take a Deep Breath. And I look forward to chatting with you in the future. Take care.
Cheers. Look forward to it. Thanks so much.
Thanks for watching, everyone. Cheers. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. I hope you like Dr. Gina. Her link is down below. Her book is out now. I highly recommend you get involved. Subscribe. She's got a free or couple of free habits courses on her website. And I think we should get her back again. That was a lot of fun. So I would think now, what changes are you going to make off the back of this podcast? Let's not waste this time that we've just spent together learning. So what's one, two, or three things? If you can only think of one, perfect. What's one change, a habit you're going to make off the back of listening to me and Gina talking together? And as a reminder, I will take on a number of limited spaces for one-to-one clients this year. If you know that breathing can help you, but you're not sure where to begin, so many contradictory breathing exercises out there, how to use the exercises, the nuances of the swapping of the breath, the inhale, the exhale, how gently, how long we should do things for, what we should do before, after exercise, and so many other things that are bespoke to you, then the link is down below where you can apply to work with me. I've been very blessed to work with a number of clients over the last couple of years. It's my favorite thing to do. And so if you want the one-on service, limited spaces are down below. So here is my favorite breathing exercise now. This is coherence breathing. We're going to play this for about 15, 20 minutes so you can just sit back and relax. This was recently featured on Dr. Andrew Huberman's podcast, where Rick Rubin, who's a famous producer for Gaga, Eminem, Beastie Boys, Johnny Cash, Metallica, Slayer, he came on and he said this exercise has raised his heart rate variability. Wow. So here is the exercise now. Sit back, relax, take gentle breaths. And again, if you're interested in working with me, the link is down below. Thank you for being here. Please subscribe if you've not done so. And here is the coherence breathing. Cheers. Welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's breathing exercise is heart coherence breathwork, an incredibly simple and powerful breathing exercise where we're going to be using our nose and we're going to be breathing in at a rate of 5.5 seconds and then breathing out using our nose at 5.5 seconds. This is a continuous breathwork exercise. This means we don't stop at the inhale or exhale. We just breathe in and we breathe out at that rhythmic rate of 5.5 seconds. Now, this is an incredibly powerful exercise because coherence breathwork allows us to use our diaphragm to pump our organs in such a way that our heart will then allow itself to get in sync with the brain. And there's all sorts of benefits. You can check out a breathcast I did with Dr. Brown. I'll link it so you can have a look at that if you want to go really into the science of what's going on here. But for those of you that just want to know a little bit, this exercise is wonderful, reducing stress, helping you get a better night's sleep and calm down and unwind and relax. So who doesn't want a little bit more of that? Just a little bit of advice before we go into the actual breathing exercise. What you don't want to do here is just completely fill up the lungs and completely empty the lungs. This shouldn't be a fast breathing exercise. It's effortless. So when we're breathing in, we hear that chime. It's not about trying to fill up everything. It's just about breathing in nice and gently.
breathing out nice and gently too, and just follow in sync. So it might take the first few breaths just to get used to, okay, how much air am I taking in? How much air am I taking out? So it's not about filling it up, but it's also not about starving yourself of air either. So you just find that nice balance. And with any great exercise, it just gets better the more you practice it. The recommendation for heart coherence breathing is around 20 minutes a day for maximum benefits. So we've designed this exercise that you can use it every day if you want. And that is it. So let's get stuck into the breathing exercise. Thank you.